is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
AJ goes down, boom, boom, knocks down both free throws. Still 2 seconds left. So I'm like, ah, we got this game. We feel good about it. LeBron takes two dribbles, half court. I mean, it rattles the rim. It goes around and it doesn't go in. And we beat LeBron. And the story gets better and better. Since I think it's 20 years. It's been 20 years. It just came up the anniversary.
Jack Agostino is in his second season as the boys basketball varsity head coach at Bayshore High School in the state of New York. Agostino previously won 473 games over the 27 years he served as head coach of Amityville High School, a public school on the south shore of Long Island, New York. Jack posted a 787 winning percentage as the Warriors head coach and ranks fifth in Long Island history in prep wins. He won four straight Class A public school and state federation titles from 2000 to 2003, becoming the only Long Island boys basketball team to accomplish that feat. Amityville won 23 league titles, 11 county class titles, and 9 Long Island titles under Agostino. Jack also spent the 2017-2018 season as the associate head coach at North Carolina A&T. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Jay Smith from the University of Michigan, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out QuickCut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. QuickCut is undeniably more affordable. It's all cloud-based and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest-growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit QuickCut.com/basketball. That's QWIKCUT.com. Grab pen and paper before you listen to this episode with Jack Agostino, boys basketball head coach at Bayshore High School in the state of New York. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here this morning without my co-host Jason Sunkel, but I am pleased to be joined by Jack Agostino, currently the head coach at Bayshore High School in the state of New York. Jack, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on. This is an exciting time, and basketball history. Unprecedented times, to be honest with you, but it's just an exciting time. So I really look forward to speaking with you.
Pretty crazy with all the COVID stuff going on, and it sort of felt like we were past that, and now everybody's having to go back and deal with it for a second time and figure out what that's going to look like. And I'm sure we'll get into exactly how you're trying to navigate that with your current team. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball.
It's amazing. Basketball was never my first love when I was growing up. I was a baseball guy my whole life. I prayed to God every day, got on my hands and knees and begged to be a professional baseball player. And it clearly didn't work out for me in that area. But God had a different plan for me. And I really started playing basketball when I was probably like 12, 13 years old. I was a late starter in the business. I played CYO and wasn't very good. And then, you know, I made the middle school team, but didn't play a lot. I made the high school team, JV and varsity, never got minutes. I think my career high was 11 points. And I think my career total in high school was like 19 points. So I didn't get a lot of playing time. But what I did do is I really listened to the coach, and I really looked at what he was doing. I was amazed at, like, you know, you can run certain things and do certain things with your team if everybody's on the same page. And we were at a pretty good high school team, and we had great friendships. But the coach wasn't really connected to the players. And as I grew older, I started to coach, you know, like CYO basketball. Then I started to coach like travel baseball teams. And I'm like, you know, maybe this is my call. This is where God is heading me to. And it really turned out to be a blessing in disguise that I became a head varsity basketball coach at 24 years old at Amityville. So it was just an amazing journey that I've been on. And, you know, with the ups and the downs, I never thought it would be basketball would be my life. I really thought it would be a different sport, baseball, football. And, you know, God laughs at man's plan for sure.
What was it about those other sports that made you think, hey, maybe I'm going to end up here as opposed to basketball? And why do you think ultimately it happened to be basketball? Just circumstance?
Yeah, I think, you know, my father was a truck driver. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I'm one of nine children, so I come from a very big family. You know, my father was just grinding every day. You know, he'd be out of the house by 5, wouldn't be home until 9 or 10. So he never spent time with us playing sports or doing things like that. But what he did teach all of us is that work ethic. And I think that's what I took from my father more than anything. Not his knowledge or love for sports, but how hard he would work for his family. And I think that was really important. So what I did is I grew up playing like in the streets, playing football and baseball. We really didn't have a lot of friends that played basketball. We didn't have basketball courts or anything in our neighborhood. So it wasn't really something that I was totally into, except I think I was in sixth grade and I did try out for this travel team. Oh, sorry about that. I did try out for a travel team and I made it, and I had a really good coach, and I remember his name was Dick Kendall, and he ended up being the head coach at Stony Brook University, which is it was a Division III at that time, but it's a Division I school now. And he really had great understanding of the game. So I think just me being around sports helped me to really get into the career of sports.
When you look back at your childhood, and you mentioned it, you know, not having a basketball court, and you think about the way that your kids that you're coaching today, the way they grew up in the game versus the way that you grew up playing sports or I grew up playing sports. When you think about that, just what are some of your memories, and maybe not even basketball related, but just of growing up as a kid and the way sports were different for somebody who was 8 years old to 15 years old back when we were kids versus what the kids that you're coaching today in high school, what their experiences are like, and just maybe compare and contrast the two childhoods.
Yeah, well, I could tell you this. When I grew up, you know, there weren't leagues, there weren't trainers, there wasn't anything. It was, you'd leave your house at 9, 10 in the morning, go up to the baseball field, go into the streets, just play all day sports. It was like so much fun. Like no parents watching you, no pressure, just a have fun with your friends. And, you know, I had a good neighborhood that we had a lot of kids my age that were playing. Amityville, to be honest with you, is very similar to my background because you know, it's not a very wealthy area, and they didn't have trainers. So all the kids in Amityville would do is meet up at the park and play. So I really had a good connection in my younger days with the kids from Amityville, because they really couldn't afford trainers, even though those were out there. They would just go to the park from early in the morning to late at night and play basketball. And I think that really helped my coaching career a lot, just to have kind of a similar upbringing. And I know today, like, I coach at Bayshore, and these kids are going to trainers. These kids have a, you know, a lot more avenues to get better. But in the Amityville days, when I first started back in 1987, they did not do that. There was just nothing happening. There was no real AAU programs. It was just, everything was to the park, go to the park, go to the park. And I feel very blessed that I could connect pretty much with those kids. Even though I wasn't playing basketball, I was playing baseball and football. It's just a little different though.
Absolutely. So when you think about yourself, if you reflect back on the first few years there as a head coach, what's something that, when you look back on it, you think, ugh, man, I wasn't very good at that particular aspect of coaching, but over time I really improved. And I know the answer to this question that everybody gives is there's too many things to list that I needed to work on. But if you think back, what's one or two things that when you look back on it, you're like, man, I really did get better at those over my career, and I really sort of did a disservice to my first team or two.
Oh, you're exactly right. It's sad to think back how I did start. Now, again, I had zero varsity basketball experience. So I took over at 24. So at 23, I was the JV girls coach in my home district, not even where I worked in Amityville. So I worked with them. And then when I was 21, I took a bunch of kids from the neighborhood where I live in Center Ridge, New York, to Villanova basketball camp. And it was a great experience. So I was kind of trying to get myself into coaching. I really wanted to coach. And I look back to my team, my first game I ever played against. This is an amazing story. Bob McKillop, who is the head coach of Davison, was a legend on Long Island. And we played him my first game ever. It was on December 7th, 1987, I believe it was. And, you know, December 7th, such a historic day. Day of Pearl Harbor, I mean, I got bombed by this guy. He just totally blew me out of the waters. My team, we couldn't bring the ball up at half court. And I think I had no knowledge of X's and O's. Like, that's one thing. I didn't know anything about basketball. I figured, all right, I got a bunch of athletic kids. Get them to run. Get them to press. But, man, I knew nothing about press breakers. I knew nothing about pulling the ball out, run some half court offense. I was just so clueless when it came to that. So clueless. And I had to take over. This is a crazy story too, that Fred Williams was a legendary athlete from Amityville. He came back to Amityville after playing Division I basketball. He was the head coach for 7 years. He gets hit with pancreatic cancer. So he finds out he's getting pancreatic cancer around. He gets pancreatic cancer around Halloween, October 31st. The athletic director goes around the whole school district and says, do you want to be the basketball coach? Do you want to be basketball? I think five guys turned the position down. The athletic director got wind that I coached JV girls basketball, came to me, said, would you take the job on an interim basis? I said, yeah, of course I'd take it. Varsity basketball coach, of course. How do I not take it? So the JV guy who was there for 20 plus years did not want the job because he knew it was impossible shoes to fill in. But I wasn't from the community. I didn't know anything about Amityville really, except for the Amityville Horror House. It's the only thing I ever knew about it. And so I said, yeah, I'll take it. So I go to visit Fred Williams in the hospital, and I speak to him. It's like one of the saddest moments of my life when I think about it. Like, he was a very thin man, tall, 6'6". African-American, the community's all African-American. I looked at him in his hospital bed, and his stomach was like protruding out like he was pregnant. So it didn't look good for the guy. But I did say to him, I said, Fred, I got you. Whenever you get back, it's your job. I'll just hold his job until you get back. And he was very appreciative. And, you know, he couldn't really talk too much, but I made a nice connection. Fast forward. This is around the beginning of November. he dies, he passes away around Thanksgiving. And now tryouts start the next day. So I'm in charge of all these kids who just lost the greatest role model they ever had, a father figure. I'm a young white guy coming into a predominantly black area, and I have to take over one of the best programs around in the county that we live in. So it was just so overwhelming. And I know I didn't answer your question totally, but I just had a lot of issues to deal with. I wasn't even thinking about, you know, the X's and O's part of basketball. I didn't even know what to do when the team pressed us. I didn't know anything. I'm telling you, you couldn't be more clueless to the game than I was. And again, I didn't grow up as a basketball guy, so I had really no clue what to do. But boy, things change. They change. And again, I said it in the beginning, you know, God laughs at man's plan, because I would have never imagined how I would take over this program or take over a basketball program.
Do you think that the most important thing you had to do was just build relationships with the kids and the community and the program? When you look back on it, is that something that was critical to your success?
I mean, I'm going to probably say this 1,000 times on your podcast. That's the only way I survived. I was not a good coach. I'm telling you straight up. But what I was good at was people skills and relationship building. And I know that's another blessing from God. People, you know, to this day can't connect to kids like I was able to. And again, I'm not trying to brag, but it was the only gift that I had to going into this business. So now I take over, continuing with the story. We play Bob McKillop, Long Island Lutheran, national powerhouse program. He's an amazing coach. And then to this day, I still speak with him every now and then, and he tells me the same thing. I said, "Coach, I mean, you beat me by 66 points. He's like, "Well, if I didn't beat you like that, you might not really have become the coach you are, because you realize you got to put the work in." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. You're right." Because it really motivated me. Like, I did not want to be embarrassed again as a coach, you know, throughout my career. But my second game of the year, I did get a little better. We lost by like 44 points. Third game, getting better. We lost by 20 plus points. So I'm like, "All right, I'm moving up." And then the fourth game of the year, we're playing the defending Long Island champion, which, you know, it's a pretty important position. You end up going to the Final Four of the States. And so I'm playing, they return their whole team, and I'm in the locker room, and I really don't know what to do to make this thing better. Like, I'm talking with my JV guy, and he, you know, he was a football guy too, so he wasn't a basketball guy, but he was in the business and had a little clue what to do. And I keep repeating myself, but the night before I got on my hands and knees, and I begged God, "Help me, help me, help me." And we're losing at halftime. Most of the kids were in the corner just killing me. I can hear him. I can feel them killing me. He don't know what he's doing. He's terrible. He's horrible. And I see one or two kids on the other side trying to, like, bring the group together. And these two kids, I'll never forget them, Mikey Benedict and Mike Addison, who, you know, were juniors at the time, said, "Coach, just be yourself." And I was like, I almost get tears thinking about that. I was like, "Yeah, I can't be Fred Williams. I can't be anybody else. I have to be myself." So that's when I realized that, build this relationship with these guys, get them to trust you, and then the X and O's will take care of itself. And lo and behold, we ended up winning the game, and the trust started to develop. And I still don't know how I did it, but I ended up making the playoffs that year, which was an amazing accomplishment. I mean, I didn't think we were going to win any game. So we ended up making it to the first round of the county playoffs. We lost at the buzzer. Terrible coaching decision on my part. But they were all juniors, so the whole team was returning. So I was like, "All right, this is when it starts coaching." And that's when I decided to bring the group to Villanova basketball camp. I drove them everywhere. They wanted to play in the city. They jumped in my car. We drove to the city. If you wanted to play out at Summer League, that was 30 miles away, I drove them everywhere. I fed them every day. And I really believed that was my strength in coaching, that I could pay for things. I had some money. They didn't have anything. So I bought, and you know, today you probably get in a lot of trouble driving kids all over the place, man. I took them on college visits. I had one Division I player, his name was Lou Wilson, and he was being recruited by St. John's and Fairleigh Dickinson. So I took him everywhere to play because I wanted him to get the exposure. You can ask my wife, I was never home. I mean, she never saw me until late at night. So I was leaving to go teach during the day. Then after school, this is after basketball season, I'm driving these kids all over the world. And I knew that the only way, like Mike Addison and Mikey Benedict told me, be yourself, coach. I knew that I'm good with people and relationships. And that's what helped go, get it going.
So
I'm going on a lot. I'm sorry. I'm a long-winded guy.
I always tell people, whenever a guest apologizes to me for being too long-winded or talking too long, I always reply with the idea that, look, that makes my job a lot easier. It's the guys who don't talk that are more difficult. The guys who love to talk, that makes it easy. I don't have to ask as many questions. You just go off on a rampage and you're ready to go. So no, I think what I hear you saying and what it sounds like is that be yourself comment is sort of a turning point for you in your career, really early on, where you just are like, hey, look, I got to be who I am. And then from there, you just kind of took the reins and utilized the strengths and what you had in order to start to build the program. And I'm assuming that not only being yourself, but I'm also assuming that as you became more consumed with the job, that you started to look around for ways to be able to improve some of those things that maybe you felt like you weren't as strong at, like, hey, I got to dive into some more X's and O's and I got to learn how to become a better coach. So how did you go about doing that? Did you have mentors in the business that you reached out to you? Were you reading at that point? Obviously video wasn't quite as easy to watch the way it would be today. So what did you do to improve as a coach once you realized that, hey, this is something that I think is going to be my passion for the rest of my life?
Well, I think the biggest thing were those team camps. Like when I went to those camps at Villanova, you know, Jay Wright was he was the director of basketball operations now. You know, he's the legendary coach over there. Rolly Massimino. They always brought in these guest speakers. And I would just sit there and take notes. So I loved that part of it. And then, you know, I started networking with these other coaches, guys from New Jersey, guys from Pennsylvania. And they said, oh, there's a great clinic. Why don't you come to the clinic? So I was like, yeah, I'll definitely do this. So I ended up going to so many clinics. But I think my greatest knowledge came from those camps. So I started working five-star basketball camp. And that's like every great coach you ever wanted to meet, they worked this camp. And there was another camp called Metro Index. It's kind of like five-star, wasn't as popular, but it was the same sort of concept. So I would go to these camps and just, you know, they pay you like 50 cents an hour. You're working from 7 a.m. to 12. and the only good thing at 12, you sit with the, you know, the college coaches, the professional coaches, and they start, you know, doing X's and O's. And I mean, I was just, I couldn't stop doing it. And they gave you free pizza and beer. So I was like, that's even better for me. I like drinking.
Those after hours coaches meetings are the best.
The best. That was where I feel like I got so much out of it. And it still took me a lot of years to figure it out. And it's weird. I've been in the business for over 30 years right now, and I'm always learning. And I think that's something, you know, other coaches who are listening to this podcast, you can never stop learning. I'm 59 years old. I started in the business at 24 years old. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't speak to somebody about basketball. And like my sons now, they're both coaches. One's a varsity coach here on Long Island. My other son is an assistant coach. My younger brothers are all varsity coaches on Long Island. And even my brother, Ralph, who lives in Ohio, he's a guy, you know, he dabbled in coaching CYO and, you know, local stuff. And every day we talk about basketball. It's unbelievable. We play golf 4 or 5 hour rounds. It's almost all basketball. We talk during the golf match or, you know, unless someone's, you know, kicking the ball out of the woods. You know, we're arguing that way. But but for the most part, I never stop learning. And I never will. I never will. Like, my son comes over. You know, he's 30 years old, Joe. And he you know, he's struggling this year. This is his first year coaching varsity. And I told him the same thing. I said, Joe, just think about my first four, five, six games. I was horrible. It took me years to develop what he knows. His knowledge is ridiculous compared to mine. Like, and I keep telling him, you know, his area isn't as talented as Amityville, but his knowledge is, God, 10 times greater than mine. So he will get it right. You know, just got to stick with it. You got to, you know, always try to learn. And, you know, any coach out there, young guys, don't ever stop learning. I love going to, like, CYO games, you know, if I know somebody playing, or middle school games, JV games. And I love watching baseline out-of-bounds plays, sideline out-of-bounds plays. I love to watch what they do versus zone, what they do against man. I like to see their different defenses. So I'm always, like, taking note, mental notes when I'm watching other coaches coach. And even, you know, you watch games, NBA games on TV. I mean, they're the greatest coaches in the world. They're amazing. And then you look at, you know, college guys, unbelievable the knowledge these guys have. Unbelievable. So don't stop learning.
Are you a paper and pencil notebook guy, or have you transferred your note-taking to computer, phone? How do you operate in terms of keeping track of all the things that you see when you're out watching games or watching tape?
Well, now it's easy because you got your phone and you just go into the notes and you just write them down like that. So it looks like, you know, you're not stealing anybody's ideas. You know, like, people, it is amazing. You know, I've been around basketball, like I said, in Suffolk County, which is the county we live in, you know, so many years. People, I walk into the gym, you're like, I'm pretty well known. And I love to speak to other younger coaches, and I love to tell them, like, wow, that was really good stuff you ran. That's really good. I love the way your kids play. You know, I think that's something, too, as an older guy, that, you know, this coaching fraternity, you know, yeah, we're competing every day against each other, but we're also here to help each other out. And, you know, I just played a game against a young coach, and his team is really good, and, you know, they beat us up pretty good. And I said to him after the game, you know, I was really impressed with your team's effort. I think that was the difference in the game, your effort. And, you know, I know he really appreciates that, because that didn't happen to me when I was younger. A couple of guys, you know, said some good things to me, and I'll get into that in a second. But I think it's really important for other coaches to support other coaches. Do you understand that? Like, where I'm going with that? That's something.
Do you think that, and I'm guessing I know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway because I think it leads to an interesting discussion. Do you think that coaches today, compared to when you first started, are more open, willing to share what they do, both from an X's and O's and a culture and a team building standpoint? Because I feel like you go back to the era when you and I were growing up, or when I was a player. So I'm talking late 80s, 90s, that I think coaches, it felt like they were more, I don't know if secretive is the right word, but they kept things close to the vest. Whereas now, everything is out there. You can obviously go on Huddle or Synergy, whatever, and you can see every single thing that everybody's running. So even if you have some great thing that you think is proprietary that nobody else can ever take, look, everybody's seeing it. Everybody's going to figure it out. And I think what that's done, in my opinion at least, is it's opened up people to say, hey, come to our practice. Hey, you want to learn more about the matchup half-court zone trap that we run? Sure, give me a call. I'll share whatever I can. And I just feel like it's opened up the coaching profession in a way that 20 or 30 years ago, it wasn't the same. And not that guys weren't friendly or whatever, but I just don't think that there was as much sharing as there is today. Have you found that over the course of your career?
Well, I think in my personal experience, I've always had good connections with other coaches. So what I did is I would ask a Jay Wright, who was the Hofstra coach, could I come to your practice? I would always, and they were always willing to let you in. So I thought that was pretty good. But I think the biggest thing today is that coaches are a little bit more insecure with themselves today. And the reason I'm saying that, because you do see everything they're doing.
Right.
Everything's out there.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
I think that's the difference. You know, when you were coaching back then, nobody knew I was a terrible coach. I mean, at least, I mean, they probably did, but they weren't seeing it every single day.
And they weren't posting it on social media every day.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, this guy is horrible. This guy. I mean, I heard it from the barbershop. You know, people come back to me and said, oh, they're killing you, Coach Hag. They're killing you in the barbershop. I said, all right, but I'm going to get better. I promise you. But today, like, you know, if you blow up on a kid, it gets, you know, like, really ugly at times. You kill guys' careers, like, sometimes. And I think that's why coaches are a little bit more insecure today versus back in the day. Like, everybody's afraid they're going to steal your ideas. And back in the days, they didn't really think that way, even though people were doing it anyway. It was right. happening. It just wasn't out there. And I think that's what makes it coaching so much harder today versus back then. You know, everything's opened up.
Right. Yeah. You're not surprising anybody anymore with you do. In very rare instances, maybe you still can. But for the most part, because everything's an open book and video is so prevalent and available and easy to use, again, compared to, I'm sure, when you started and you're on the VHS tapes and all that kind of stuff and trying to rewind and catch clips and all that, compared to what we have today, it's not even comparable in any way, shape, or form. So let's
talk. This is kind of funny. Real quick. This is funny. Just the other day, my games now are mainstream through, you know, in the gymnasium. So as soon as, you know, you don't have to have a camera guy anymore. It's just they film the games at all your home games, and it goes right onto Huddle. So our game was delayed a little because the referee was running late. So the other team went into the locker room. So I don't even remember we're being filmed right now. So I'm going over my half-court offense. I'm going over my baseline out of bounds plays, and it's all on the camera.
All being
right there.
Streamed. There you go.
It's being streamed, so you can see what I'm running. So it's not like we weren't even running it well with no defense out there. So we're having trouble running it with defense. So I'm like, okay, so everybody in the world knows my little half court offense, and I'm putting in my new baseline out of bounds play. It's just funny because, like, I would have never thought that. And then when I get home, and I'm like, I'm going over the tape, and I'm like, wow, this athletic director just filmed my whole half-court offense. It's kind of funny. So go ahead. Hey,
I missed the manager's comments, the guys who's filming the camera, you know, who's filming the game. You don't get to hear those anymore. Where the manager mistakenly starts swearing about something or starts saying, that was a stupid play the coach just ran, and then you get to hear that, and you get to hear that in the film session. I miss those days.
That is so much fun. I miss those days.
So going back to where you are with Amityville early in your career. So obviously the program has had some success. How do you go about building it into a team that eventually wins multiple state championships? What does that look like? What do you think were some of the keys to what you eventually were able to do? Obviously, we've already mentioned one, which is building relationships with your kids and basically doing anything that you possibly could to help them not only get better as basketball players, but to give them opportunities off the basketball floor as well. So beyond that, what do you think were one or two of the keys that if there's a high school coach out there listening that might be replicable for somebody else that you think led to your success?
The next part of the equation was to get to the younger group of kids. So I connected with our local CYO program, which was St. Martin's. And a man named Richie Cronin, Anthony Crocito, who's now the head coach at St. Leo's in Tampa, Florida for the women's program, and Wayne Jones. So I connected with these three guys, and they had a really good youth program. Like, that CYO program was really good. So I would go and do some free clinics for them. Even though they knew more than I did, to be honest with you. So I would just go there to meet the kids and, you know, see them. And then I used to go down to the elementary school. So I knew the phys ed guys down there. So I would go in there and speak with them. I would bring a couple of older players with me, you know, seniors, and let them speak to the kids. And I thought that was really, really a good way to connect to the younger group, because the area is very talented. But a lot of those kids would transfer out to the private schools. So now this is a public school, a small public school. It just wasn't, you know, as many opportunities for them to go on to college playing in a small public school. They had a way better chance going into the bigger private schools. So I was like, I have to stick with, you know, the youth. So I would always go down to the elementary schools. I would always connect with the CYO guys. I would go to their games. So they would say, Coach Ag, we're playing in a championship game Sunday at 4:00. Well, guess what? I'm there. So I was at my face was always around. So now these younger kids start to connect with me also. So then my wife and I, who really deserves so much credit. I said I'm going to have to speak about her eventually. So this is really funny, and I'll get back to the story. So my wife, I get elected into the New York State Hall of Fame. I get elected into the Amityville Hall of Fame. I get into the Long Island Hall of Fame. I never thank my wife, But today on this podcast, I think every young coach should thank their wives for being so supportive. And I got out there. Her name is Debbie. She's an unbelievable mom, wife, friend. She's the key to my success. There's no doubt about it. So her and I ended up starting a basketball camp. She would do all the paperwork, everything. And there was no computers then. And in Amityville, so the summer, we would charge kids like $10 to come to this basketball camp. I had over 100 kids in this camp. We would, you know, give out Gatorades. We would give out awards. And then I would use my older guys to work, that, you know, the kids that were seniors and going on to college. And all they would do was just watch me work. They would just sit. And I was like, can you go help this guy, like Mike James, who's an NBA player? Mike, can you take that team and, you know, put half-court offense in for it? Yeah, sure, coach. I always had to coach them during the camp time. But I think once I started running that camp and connecting with the youth programs and getting down to the elementary schools and the middle school, I felt like that really helped propel the program. I think that was really a big key.
Yeah, there's two things there that I've had this conversation with multiple high school coaches where I really think that this is one of the things that I think sometimes today, I don't know if it's as prevalent as it was, but I do think that being visible, like you mentioned, and going to, as a high school varsity coach, going and watching the younger kids in your school system and your feeder program, whatever it is, wherever the kids that are ultimately going to go to your high school, being visible so those kids know who you are and you know them by name or by face, you get to know some parents. There's nothing more valuable. There's nothing more valuable than that. And I think that those kids then get a chance to see you and say, hey, one day I'd like to play for Coach Agostino. And if they don't know who you are, they're never going to feel that way. And then to go along with that same thing by having the camp and having your varsity players work with those kids. Now we talked about relationships earlier. So now those youth players are building a relationship with those varsity players, makes them want to come to a game on Friday night. Now they watch them play. They're like, hey, that was my coach at camp. Wow. Mm-hmm. Someday I'd like to be that kid who's out there. And it just gives them this aspirational feel of someday I want to suit up for Amityville High School. And I think if you don't have that, it becomes really easy, especially in today's transfer crazy world where you come up and it used to be, I think that if you went to public school, you kind of knew who your teammates were. Like I look back and my pictures of third, fourth grade basketball, and I look at the kids and all the kids that were playing on teams that I was on were either my teammates as high school basketball players, or they were some of the better athletes that just ended up going into a different sport. But nobody went to this school or transferred to that school or was over here. Right. Whereas now, if you don't build the connections and really recruit your own players, it gets really, really tough if you're not building those relationships. So I think those are two really key points that I can see where being able to develop your program, that was critical for you to be able to do that. You mentioned Mike James. Not many guys get an opportunity to coach an NBA player. So talk a little bit about what that experience was like, how special it was, when you recognize that, oh my gosh, like I have a guy here who he's got a chance to maybe play at the highest level, maybe what set him apart as a player that allowed him to get to that point in his career.
Well, I'm smiling right here because I never believed he would be an NBA player. I never believed that he was undersized, loved basketball, had tremendous passion for basketball. And, you know, he grew by his junior year. He was, you know, a knockdown three-point shooter. He was a very good ball handler. But he wasn't being recruited. So, like, I didn't know anybody who was, you know, big-time players at that time. And, you know, like, I know that, you know, he was on the AAU circuit. So I was like, okay, so at least he's going to get out there. Nobody's recruiting the kid. Nobody. So I'm like, who would ever thought this kid's going to be an NBA player? But that's one little advice I wanted to give to young coaches too. You know, everybody has these issues with AAU guys that, you can't. You got to put it aside. You and the AAU guy have to work together. And that's another benefit that I really established. I think on Long Island, I probably have the greatest connections with these AAU guys because they wanted my players as we got better. But I also wanted them to get great exposure. And the AAU circuit is where you're going to get the exposure. the college guys mainly go out in the summertime, you know, before all this COVID stuff. So that you need to have a connection with a good AAU program. And so there's a guy in our area named Gary Charles, who's a legend on the AAU circuit. He knows everybody in the business, and I'm still friendly with him today. And, you know, and so many people, you know, behind his back would talk negative about him. And I thought that was total BS. I wanted to build that relationship with Gary. And to this day, he really helped me out a lot as a young coach, really helped me out a lot. Yes, he was taking my players and bringing them all over the place, and maybe he could have fed them to a private school, you know, who was maybe, you know, giving some donations to his program. But all I knew is that that AAU connection was very important for me and my success. And I think every high school coach should not take it as a personal insult or a disrespect to them that their kids don't play the right way in AAU. You want your kids to get as much exposure as possible. And I think that's another part of my, you know, my legacy in Amityville. Once I got connected to AAU programs, I was able to get kids into college a lot easier. Like they saw them on a circuit, so I can make a phone call. Did you see Jay Joyner? Did you see Mike James? Did you see these guys? And then all of a sudden, college coaches were starting to call me, and they saw me at all the AAU events also. So it, as a young coach going forward, don't be insecure. Be confident that you and the AAU coach will help build your program.
And I think that's really a two-way street from a standpoint of, I always look at that relationship between a high school coach and an AAU coach or an AAU program as long as both parties are doing what they're doing with the best interest of the player front of mind, then I think those relationships work great. I think sometimes when coaches on either side of that equation get territorial, or you hear somebody say, "Oh, that's my player." Well, not really. You know, you're there. You're there, hopefully, as the coach to serve the player. Now, granted, the player is going to help you win games and be a part of your program, but ultimately, you as the coach are there to help your player. And hopefully, on the AAU side, that's the same thing. When you get somebody who is a good quality AAU coach running a good quality AAU program, they know why they're there. They're there to help players get better and get opportunities to play in the off season, but also, as you said, to get exposure to college coaches, because we all know that when a college coach can go out and go to an AAU tournament and see 25 players that they might recruit versus going to one high school game, it's just not as efficient. And then now, as you mentioned, with COVID, coaches are finding even more so, and the film is so good anymore, and every single thing is available that you can, you know, now you can find guys anywhere. But I think that relationship between a high school coach and an AAU coach, you hit on it, that it's really critical. If you can form good relationships, it can be a positive for both your program as a high school coach, but also for your players. And conversely, if you look at it and you're insecure or you don't feel like it's going to be a good relationship, you can kind of sabotage your players, maybe unintentionally, but you can still sabotage them if there's that wall between the high school program and an AAU program. I just think you're doing your kids a disservice. And ultimately, to me, you have to do what's best for the kids.
Yes. And, you know, the one thing, the AAU circuit is unbelievable. Mike, I don't know if you've been on the highest level, but I have been. And there's not a lot of guys in the business that really want to take the kids' best interests. It's the AAU guys do look out for themselves and their program. But with that being said, I still think the most important relationship you can get is even with those guys that might not have the student athlete's best interest at heart. You still have to have that, because that highest level, and I had some high major Division I players, without me having that connection, I'm not sure I could have got those kids to that point. I know, because I just didn't have the opportunities to know.
Right, for sure.
You're right. Sonny Vaccaro. Like Sonny Vaccaro to me is a man who transformed high school basketball. You know, he was the guy who signed Michael Jordan. He's the guy who signed Kobe Bryant. He signed LeBron James. Like, he was there. And I would have never met him if it wasn't for Gary Charles. And to me, he's one of the biggest inspirations in my life, Sonny Vaccaro, because he absolutely had the kids' best interest. Now, he gets beat up in the media every now and then. You know, he was greedy. He was never like that. His wife, Pam, and him were amazing to these families. And I'm talking about kids that had nothing. Like he would fly them all over the country to play in tournaments. He would put them up in hotels. He would be feeding them. That to me, that was, he was the father of AAU basketball. So everybody took their information from him. So even though it doesn't always seem like on the surface that these AAU guys have the student athlete's best interest, in the long run, they really do. And I know it's not always clear, but I've witnessed it on my own that it is very, very important to have that connection if you want your kids to be at the highest level.
Right. They have to be able to get that exposure to college coaches. And it's much more difficult, I think, at the high school level, again, just because what we talked about, where you're putting a whole bunch of players in the same place at the same time. You got a bunch of high-level players playing on the same team, playing against high-level competition. And then the AAU guys are motivated from a standpoint of building those relationships with college coaches, because then the better the relationships that they have with college coaches, the better relationships they can have with players and high school coaches and get more people into their program. And it's all just this big, long cycle that, you know, it's interesting how it all
you can't
works.
Stop it. It's an unbelievable machine.
Yeah.
And so you have to join forces. You cannot stop it. So that's
you can't
what
fight the machine.
You can't fight the machine. Machine is so powerful. And really it starts with the college coaches. You know, the college coaches are the ones who are feeding these AAU programs. That's where it's coming from. And not even the college, it's sneaker companies. They're feeding the AAU program. So, you know, it's all about getting that next Kobe, get the next LeBron, get the next Michael. That's how it was. And Sonny Vaccaro was the grandfather. But what happened with Mike James, going back to him, he got with Gary Charles, and they were called the Long Island Panthers. And, you know, Gary was just kind of starting out, and Mike James was one of his first group of young guys to really hit the national circuit. And Mike James played with Zenden Hamilton. So now Mike's getting himself a lot of exposure. Zero to do with me, because again, he was being recruited by nobody. So he comes back his senior year, and he had an unbelievable junior year. You'd think everybody in the country would want this kid, but you know, from Long Island, that's just not happening. So he goes on the circuit, has a great, you know, summer circuit going into his senior year, and still only one or two schools are recruiting him. They're Division II schools. And I remember the one school, I'm not going to name their names, but they took him up for a visit. It was in New Hampshire, you know, Long Island, so it's a cold area. The kid just wanted to go to play college basketball somewhere. And the coach calls me up after the visit and says, nah, this kid's not good enough to play Division II basketball. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Then I'm calling Jay Wright, and, you know, he's at Hofstra. I'm like, Jay, what do you think? He says, nah, coach, he's not good enough to play at our level. And I don't know how to tell the kid this. This kid is determined to be a Division I player. So Gary Charles hooks up a prep school for him. Kid goes to prep school and blows up on his prep school circuit. So now Fairley Dickerson finally comes in, kind of starts recruiting him, because Gary Charles has a great relationship with the coaches there. And the kid plays in one more tournament, last tournament. Duquesne University comes down. They're looking for a point guard. They come down because of Gary Charles. And the kid plays amazing in this park pickup game, basically. So they sign him right there. He goes into the Atlantic 10, Mike James, and kills the Atlantic 10. Then he gets his degree in child psychology, which I was so proud of. He ends up playing overseas for a couple of years. And Pat Riley and his crew kind of saw Mike James in this work ethic, that this kid is like determined. He will not leave the court. And Pat Riley signed him with the Miami Heat, and the kid ended up spending 13 years in the NBA, winning the NBA championship with the Detroit Pistons. I was taken to so many great games, great venues, just because of Mike James. And going back, he really was not considered a Division I player. But the one thing that separated him from everybody else is his work ethic. Going back to that, like, kid would – he lived right behind the park in the area. His house was right behind the park. And so he would go out there, shovel snow. He would just go every day and shoot and play. And to this day, I've never met a player that put in more time than Mike James. And that's why he's in the NBA and had a great NBA career.
You just don't hear about guys who have success without some version of that story that you just told. It's very, very rare that you hear the story. I guess every once in a while you can have a guy who's just an unbelievable athlete that doesn't have the work ethic. And he's probably just a guy that doesn't ever reach his potential, but may be a good player simply because they just have tools. But guys who reach that highest level, those stories rarely come without the one that you just told about Mike James, where I do whatever it takes, and I'm relentless, and I put the work in, I put the time in, I keep improving, I keep getting better. And again, it just shows you that scouting and figuring out who can play and who can't, it's still, even with all the tools that we have today and all the film and all the information that these teams gather, you still don't know. And ultimately, when you think about guys who have success in the NBA and you talk to NBA people or you just read stories, it ultimately comes down to the guys who have the most success, the guys who end up maximizing their potential, whether that means they're an all-NBA player or whether that means they're able to be the 10th man on a bench somewhere. Those guys get there because they put the work in, and they put the work in on the floor. They study film. They do all those things. And if you're not going to do that, you're just not going to have success at those highest levels. It's almost impossible.
Impossible. That is so true. Those stories. You know, my favorite player of all time is Kobe Bryant. I just love talking about Kobe. And I met him a couple of times, and you know, he spoke to kids. I always was blessed enough to work the ABCD camps, which very few high school coaches get to work. But once I started getting some great players, I started getting invited to these things through Sonny Vaccaro and Gary Charles. And Kobe would come in and speak all the time. And he just talked about that. It's about the work. You really don't understand if you want to make it. It's about putting in that work. Like every kid, you know, pretty much if you got some skills, you put that work in, there's nobody can stop you. But kids are not willing to do that as much as you think. Like it's so hard to get to that level. And they don't understand what the work that Kobe was talking about. And I try to explain it to my team today, and they just don't understand it. Like it's hard to explain unless Kobe spoke to you. You know, coming from me, it's a little different. If Kobe speaks to you, you can't believe it.
But even that, it's almost like you'd have to watch like a 24-hour a day reality show of Kobe for a week to really get a feel for what takes. You know what I mean? And obviously he's on the maniacal side of even beyond what you would normally say is a tremendous work ethic. Kobe's work ethic, second to none, probably of anybody who's ever played the game. But it's just, you think about trying to explain that to a high school player. And I always equate it to when you ask a kid, hey, you think you played hard in that game? And we all know the answer that a kid's going to give to their coach, right? Every kid's going to say, yeah, I played hard. And yet you could go watch the film and point out 50 instances of where they probably didn't. But at the same time, in their mind, they just can't make that. They can't make that leap, whether that's through their own understanding of the game, whether that's through maturity, whatever it is. It's just such a different way of looking
at it. You can't explain it.
Yeah, you can't explain it. And it's just different. And again, we've talked about it before a little bit earlier about how kids today with the trainers and with the AAU circuit and different. You mentioned five-star earlier. I think about if you took a kid who was a top 20 player nationally right now today and you said, hey, we're going to fly you out to Robert Morris College and you're going to play basketball for 8 hours a day on some converted tennis courts in 100 degree weather on asphalt, that kid would look at you and their family would look at you like you were completely insane. And yet for 25 years, 30 years, the best players in the country went through five-star and all the best coaches, let's be honest.
I mean, absolutely.
That place was just a complete breeding ground for great coaches, great players, and the influence that Garf and the group there had on basketball is, I mean, it's immeasurable. And it's just, again, the system is different now.
Yeah.
And you can make arguments both ways, but I think when you look back on those times and you think about what the opportunities kids have to get into gyms and to be able to have, as you said, more resources, more avenues to be able to get better, it's just a totally different world than it used to be.
And honestly, it's such a blessing for coaches what Goff and Tom Kinchowski and the Sonny Vaccaros of the world, they did. They opened it up not only for players, but for coaches to improve. And again, it's the same thing. Some coaches aren't willing to put the time in. Some can't put the time in. You know, they got young families. But
right.
Again, things just don't happen magically. You know, the Amityville basketball program, which became a legendary program, didn't happen magically. It was a lot involved in it. And I'm so glad I'm getting to tell my story. You know, we have the documentary out now that Richie Brown put together with the Give Back Network. And
yeah, tell people where they can find that. Let's do that now. We can mention it again at the end, but tell people where they can find that.
Well, Richie Brown came to me. He's a local JV basketball coach who started his own little business, his own little network. It's called the Give Back Network. And he asked me, he's like, Coach, how come nobody's told your story? I said, well, nobody's asked me about it. So he ended up, and this was right in the heart of COVID back in March of 2021. There was nothing going on. I had nothing to do. So he called me up. We met by a Starbucks. I gave him all these videos. I gave him, you know, my story. I told my story to him a little. And could you get the players? I said, yeah, I could get you the players. I have still tremendous relationships with Mike James and Jason Frazier and Tristan Smith. They all were part of the AJ Price. They were all part of it. And we ended up, you know, putting it together. It took like a year. And again, it's not like ESPN 30 for 30, but it's catching on. People are starting to like it. He's getting a lot of views. And, you know, he's going to end up bringing it to like some different film festival stuff and see if somebody picks up on it. But it's a great story. And it's called Small Town Greatness. And really Amityville is a very small town of, I don't even know what the population is, but you know, our school is not one of the biggest schools on Long Island, but it's a neighborhood of maybe like a 2 or 3 mile radius that all these players came from. They all live in the neighborhood. I did not recruit kids. Kids would come and call me and say, I want to come to your school. I said, you got to get an address. You got to live in the area. So I had opportunities to bring in some great players, which I won't bring up any names. Their parents came to me. But after they saw, it was all kids from the neighborhood. It was a neighborhood group of kids. Here's my dogs.
There we go.
Mailman must be coming.
My dog's sitting on the bed next to me. So I'm surprised. Anything happens at my house, you'll be hearing my dog too. So it's not unusual.
Yeah. So it was just, you know, like amazing how that this young kid, Richie Brown, ended up telling the story. And, you know, and again, you know, the game against LeBron puts us on the map. That's, you know, we don't beat LeBron. This stuff never happens. And, you know, nobody's really hearing about our story. So I give a lot of credit to LeBron James for my success.
Talk a little bit about that LeBron game.
That was crazy. That was the most amazing time of my life. It was December 2001. It was LeBron's birthday. I think he's December 30th. He just had his birthday, I believe. I think it's 28th or 29th.
That sounds
or 30th.
Right. That's
yeah, somewhere in there. Right. And so he turned 17 years old. And we played in a national tournament down in Delaware. And what happened is I had a great player. His name was Jason Frazier, who ended up going to Villanova. Probably would have been a high lottery pick if he came out of high school, but he decided to go on to college and play for Jay Wright. And, you know, he got injured 4 straight years. He had knee surgeries, but he was the top 5 players in the class of 2001. And if you look back to that class, that's Carmelo Anthony, Amari Stoudemire, Chris Bosh. So he was top 5 with those guys. And so we ended up playing LeBron in this national tournament. We beat Bishop Laughlin, who's a powerhouse in New York City Catholic League. We beat them the first game. So we stayed in this little cheesy hotel. It was unbelievable. They put LeBron in a palace. Myself and Danny Hurley, who's the head coach at UConn right now. Danny and I stayed in this little cheesy hotel. We're like, wow, nobody's caring about us. He coached St. Benedict's with J.R. Smith. So he played LeBron the first game, and I kept saying, I'm scouting the game. I'm like, I don't want to play Danny's team. This team looks really good. I'd rather play LeBron. And LeBron's team ended up winning their semifinal game. We beat Bishop Laughlin. We have to wait 5 more days before we play LeBron. So they made it. We played like a Monday, and then we didn't play again until a Saturday night. So I had to babysit all these kids. I didn't have the greatest hotel situation. It was a very tough experience. I also had to have my tooth pulled, which is unbelievable. Like, I had a big hole in my mouth. The kids are laughing at me the whole time. I had a big abscess on my tooth.
On the road, getting your tooth pulled. That's
in
no
Delaware.
Fun.
That's no fun. No. So we end up getting to the game, and the place is packed, and the hype. LeBron's team, St. Mary St. Vincent, was ranked third in the country. Amityville was not on the map. We had one great player, but we did have a sleeper player. He was only a sophomore. His name was A.J. Price, who didn't have the national recognition, but he was very good. And, you know, he ends up being an NBA player. And, you know, my kids were really excited to play somebody like LeBron and St. Mary St. Vincent. And, you know, it was just unbelievable, the hype machine. And there was no social media like we talk about. There was none of that stuff back then. It was just like some little internet sites, but it was the crowd and the atmosphere was amazing. And everybody knew LeBron was going to be something special. And, you know, he ended up getting 39 points against us. We're winning by three with like 10 seconds left. He pulls up for a three. We foul him too late. We should have fouled earlier, which I wasn't a very smart coach either then. And he hits the three, gets the free throw. So they go up by one. His coach, Drew Joyce, whose son was a great player at University of Akron, and that whole crew ended up going to Akron beside LeBron, and they press us. At, you know, even though they were up by one, they press us. So gave us, you know, we have a great, you know, press breaker. Finally, I learned from Long Island Lutheran, get it to your big guy. Jason Frazier turns, looks the length of the court. He sees A.J. Price wide open, goes in for a layup, and I think LeBron fouls him. And he had a foul because it was 2 points. We win by one. So this young sophomore, A.J. Price, gets to the foul line. And right before that, we could have iced the game. He missed two free throws. So that's why LeBron had the chance to make the three to tie. He gets up to the line. Jason Frazier goes up to him, who was our senior, and says, I believe in you, A.J. I believe in you. Something very positive. A.J. goes down. Boom. Boom. Knocks down both free throws. Still 2 seconds left. So I'm like, we got this game. We feel good about it. LeBron takes two dribbles, half court. I mean, it rattles the rim. It goes around and it doesn't go in. And we beat LeBron. And, you know, the story gets better and better since, I think it's 20 years. It's been 20 years. It just came up the anniversary.
Probably feels like it was yesterday.
Oh, my God. I just wish it was more of the, you know, the video out there. There's not a lot of video. We did film the game. So you'll see some footage, but, you know, it was a mom. It was AJ's mom who filmed the game for us. That was the video we had. And, you know, people would always say, oh, can I get a copy? So I always gave it out. Like, it's probably out there somewhere, but
right.
I wasn't even thinking about it like it would be a very popular DVD right now.
That's funny. There's a clip on Twitter right now that's circulating of, I don't even know who LeBron's playing against, but it's a montage of about 40 seconds of LeBron high school highlights.
Yeah.
And the caption says, these highlights are all from one half of one game. And I mean, it's just ridiculous. I remember I saw him play once in person when he was in high school. And obviously he was not that far away from me being in Cleveland and him being in Akron. And I saw him play when he was a junior. And the thing that I remember more than anything else, obviously just from a physical, just size, speed, strength. I mean, it would look like an NBA player playing against 10-year-olds. But I just remember him covering the stride, like his stride length going down the floor. When you watch him running down the floor compared to like a high school kid that you're used to watching. And I remember 2, 3, 4 steps and he's just from half court and he's at the basket dunking. And there's a reason why he's wherever you want to rank him in the top 2, 3 players of all time.
No doubt.
You know, there's no question that those guys are just, they're built differently. And he's obviously gone on. There's never been anybody who has had as much hype as what he had at age 15.
And to live up to that hype.
And probably exceeded it, which is almost impossible, which is almost impossible to believe. And not only exceeded it as a basketball player, but just you think about all the potential things that could have gone wrong for him off the court or just handling the media or whatever it might be. Let's put it this way. His biggest misstep probably that people have criticized him for is the decision. And if he hadn't made that decision on TV,
Yeah.
I don't think you can criticize it at all. And probably here in Cleveland, we probably feel worse about that than anybody. But, man, to do what he did, especially when you consider his upbringing and background and whatever. And so for you and your team and your community to be able to have that win in your back pocket and just to be, whatever, a small part of his story, but a part that you can always look back on and say, yeah, we beat that guy once upon a time.
That's I believe he only lost five high school games. I believe he lost twice to Carmelo. I know that.
He lost, and they didn't win the state title when he was a junior.
Yeah, that year, right. I think that year
so,
that they didn't win something, right. I remember that.
Yeah, but the summer
of his, going into his junior, before we played him, he was at ABCD camp, and that's when I first saw him, and I was like, wow, this kid is really something special. And I ended up like talking with him every, you know, because I was a coach, and I would talk to the kids. I had Kendrick Perkins on my team, so I had some good players too. And, you know, we'd play each other in these little tournaments that Sonny Vaccaro would set up, and it was in Fairleigh Dickinson, New Jersey. And we were just sitting around watching games, and his mom and him were sitting right next to me, and we were talking. And, you know, I had Jason Frazier. So Jason Frazier was the big name at that time. And I just remember telling LeBron that, you know, keep your group small. Don't expand your group, because I think that's what happened a lot with Jason Frazier. His group got so big, and he had so many people telling him how to decide where to go. So I really learned that lesson. I did pass it on to LeBron. I'm not even sure if he would even remember the conversation. I doubt it. But it's just something. It does seem like he keeps his inner circle very small, because I think when that circle opens up, that's when all the distractions and all the crazy people come in. And you know, LeBron to me looks like a great dad. He looks like a great husband. He really is very grounded. And that to me is more important to me. Like, I see his talent and, you know, his NBA championships and all that stuff, but he seems like a really good guy, down to earth person. And I think, you know, people, you know, again, social media, they have no idea who these kids are and what they came from. And so LeBron to me he's not only a tremendous player, but he definitely has a special way about him. You can really sense that when you talk with him.
I agree. I really think
it's something that people of Cleveland can kind of connect to, and the people, you know, that have ever seen him play and have any sort of personal connection, you probably can sense that. And I got the same feeling when I spoke with Kobe a couple times too. Same thing.
I mean, it's what makes those guys special. Yeah. Obviously, the basketball talent is a huge part of it, but the ability to handle yourself in other areas of your life. We've all seen, I mean, we could go through tons of stories of guys who had a lot of talent that ended up not maximizing that talent because of off-court decisions and things that they did, and just never lived up to the hype. And there's very, very few guys who have been hyped as much as LeBron was, especially at such an early age. And there's nothing in his background that would suggest that he would be someone who would be as sharp with the media, that would be as together off the court as he's been able to do. And to your point, I think you look at the success of that inner circle that he put together and what they've done with Clutch Sports and just Maverick Carter, the success he's had. And again, those are all guys that knew him.
His true friends in his whole business.
Right. And so there's very few people, I think, that have cracked that circle that didn't know him when he was 12, 13, 14 years old. And so that's probably why he's had so much success.
Yeah. And he's just a great role model. And my other quick story with him is that year he was a senior, he was at ABCD camp, I believe. No, maybe his junior, I can't remember. So I was picked to be the all-star coach. So I had Sebastian Telfair on my team. LeBron was on the other team. And we had mainly the New York kids playing against the rest of the country and LeBron. So I had all these New York kids, and man, they were like tough, tough city kids. They weren't any kids from Amityville, so it was only kids from New York. And in the All-Star game, and it was packed. Fairleigh Dickinson, that's what everybody looked forward to in the ABCD camp, was the All-Star game. So they had an underclassman All-Star game and a senior. So I was picked to coach the underclassman, and LeBron was on the other team. And Sebastian, you know, Sebastian Telfair, played in the NBA. And all the guys that were on the team, we ended up beating LeBron that game too. So I got a 2-0 record against LeBron.
Nice. There you
go. I don't
know
if people can say that.
That's probably, you probably got the best record in history against LeBron.
In history, that's for sure. That's for sure.
All right, let's transition.
Sure.
Let's move to the next stage of your career when you decide to retire, you walk away from Amityville, You're going to get into college coaching. Let's talk about these next couple phases and get you to where you are now at Bayshore. Just kind of take us through that story.
So in 2014, it's a crazy story, but I'm telling it because I don't care anymore. So my high school team in Amityville wins the county championship. So the other team, John Glenn High School, decides to place a protest against my team. And I'm like, wait, what are they protesting? So I ended up, I had three kids foul out of the game. So I put in a kid from JV because I had no other guards. He was in eighth grade. I put him into the game the last 13 seconds of the game. Does not touch the ball, just stands in the corner. And we're down one. I was small enough. I designed a pretty good play. We executed it well. We score. We win the game. Kid doesn't touch the ball, the eighth grader. I get wind from the athletic director of Amityville saying that the game is under protest because you played an illegal player. I'm like, who? Who was the illegal player? They said the eighth grader. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, he wasn't cleared for varsity. I was like, so I was dumbfounded. I didn't know what was going on. So the section committee got together and took the championship away from us, ended up giving it to the other team. I'm still to this day mind boggled how that happened. But, you know, that was the rules. We played a kid who wasn't varsity ready or whatever. So now that was, you know, 2014. It was like this, you know, March, somewhere around there. So now the community is up in arms. They're going crazy. We had a brand new superintendent. She just takes over. She's inexperienced. She's getting bombed by the community. Like, how could this happen? The media is getting all over. How can you let this happen? How can you let this happen? So, you know, she ended up becoming very mad at me. Like, I had something to do with the community to get after her, and I didn't. And she decided to, like, kind of, you know, push her weight around and say, you know what, we're not going to bring you back as the coach for next year. And I'm like, what? This is 2000. I just won the county championship. I'm a legend in the town. The community goes crazy now. They go ballistic. And they have a big board meeting. And I'm like, oh my God, this is sick. Like, they're really going this way. So she ended up having enough votes not to recommend me for the position. I'm like, you know what? Listen, God laughs at man's plans. I'm not fighting you. I don't care where this goes. So my son was a high school sophomore and junior. So I'm like, I never got to see any of my kids. I have four kids. They all played high school sport. I never saw them play. So I'm like, you know what? This is a blessing. I'm going to go watch my son play. And, you know, he has a great couple of years. You know, he's like one of the best kids in the county. I'm so happy for him. You know, he goes on to college, has a pretty good career there. And his name is Jonathan, and he's my assistant coach now. So the time I spent with him really built some great family bonding. So now we fast forward to 2017. So I'm just kind of running my own little program of basketball training. I'm running camps, clinics. So I'm, you know, my name is still pretty popular out there, and everybody knows I got screwed by this superintendent. So I really didn't push for the job anymore. And they were horrible at it. But they didn't make the playoffs like a couple of years. And I'm like, oh, this is terrible. The kids are calling me, the community, you got to come back. I can't come back unless this lady puts me up. So I was still working in the building. And so this is the great part. I leave this building at 2:30 every day. It was unbelievable. Like, I had like a real life. Like, I could do other things. So now one of my former players becomes the head coach at North Carolina A&T, Jay Joyner. Great kid. Him and I have a really good relationship. He's like, coach, he gets his first year, he wins three games. He goes 3-25. He's devastated. It's like impossible. He was a junior college coach. He was an assistant coach on the Division I level, but he really needed like a loyal guy with him. So he's like, coach, I really need you. Can you come down and help me out? I said, you know what? Yeah, let me try it. I've always wanted to be a Division I coach, and this was a great opportunity. So I end up accepting the position, 2017, but I still had to. I wasn't 55 years old. And I mentioned it before, the superintendent, even though she was hating on me a little, she did sign the agreement that on my birthday, I don't have to teach and I can get all my New York State pension. That's what I really wanted. So then I can make the move to North Carolina. So I go down. She puts in the papers and lets me retire on September 21st. So I had to work. This was the craziest time. I was coaching. I started in July in Greensboro, North Carolina. So in September, I had to fly back for a couple days do some work, go back to North Carolina for practice, fly back up to New York, do some work in the school, go back. I had to do that for 3 weeks. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm spending way more money than I'm making. So I'm flying back and forth to North Carolina. So now we get into the heart of the season. We're doing preseason workouts, and I'm learning so much about coaching. And again, I was 55 years old. I had a career worth of coaching, but now at the college level, it takes it to a whole different level. Not a high school coach, if they've never experienced, can understand the time you put in as a college coach. So I had to do all this traveling, but when I was down at the school, I had to get to the office by 8 a.m. I wouldn't leave the office until probably 9, 10 o'clock at night. And in that time frame, I had to work out with kids. I had to go recruit players. I had to go to classrooms to go check on the kids. I had to practice plan. I had to do film sessions. And I'm like, this is unbelievable. But it was such a wealth of knowledge for me. I've learned and I learned. I watched film. Like you said, Synergy was like my best friend. I was a pro at Synergy. I could do anything on. I could clip up things. I didn't know how to do any of this stuff. And then when you get into the college atmosphere and the games and all the coaches are very, very talented and the players, every kid wants to be an NBA player. So they're really into it. It was such an amazing experience. And Coach Joyner really wanted me there. And that felt really good, really, really good. So him and I had a good connection because, you know, in the college business, you cannot trust anybody. They were all trying to get your jobs. Every guy you hired, they're trying to get your job. So,
right.
You know, he was in a tough situation. So that year we ended up winning 20 games, which was I think it's the second greatest Division I turnaround, from 3 wins to 20 wins. And it was an amazing experience. And looking back, I wish I stayed. And I tell Coach Joyner this all the time. But my wife, it was very hard to live in New York and in North Carolina. She was not moving. And so she would travel down like on New Year's Eve, Valentine, like all special holidays. She was down there. She was making food. I didn't know how to cook. I grew up in an Italian family. My mother did everything. I didn't even know how to do laundry. I didn't go away to college. I went to local colleges. So I didn't know any of this stuff. So I'm on my – this is the first time in my life at 55 years old, I'm living on my own.
You had that young coach experience, like normally that the guy who's 23 years old and living in somebody's basement on a mattress.
I had to do it at 55.
At 55, exactly.
Yeah. So it was just such a great experience and, you know, getting to know the players. I still have really good relationships with the players today. And I just really, really enjoyed the experience and just being in it. But I really appreciate coaching so much more, like the time that you have to put in. And we go back to Kobe and all these great players and Mike James and Jason Frazier and AJ Price. The time they put in just is incredible. And there's coaches out there that double the players' times, which is amazing to me. Amazing story. So I don't know if I hit on what I was –
No, you did. No, you absolutely did. All right, let's get to Bayshore and let's wrap up with a two-part question that's going to give you a chance to tell the story of how you get back to Bayshore. So when you look at where you are now, and obviously you're back in the high school ranks where you spent the majority of your career, and when you think ahead to the next year or two, what's the biggest challenge that you have in front of you? And then let's wrap up with the second part of that question, which is what's the biggest joy when you get out of the morning, get out of bed in the morning, and you think about what you get to do on a daily basis, what's your biggest joy? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
The biggest challenge is kind of going back to when I first started, is building those relationships. Like, I don't know the families of Bayshore as well yet. You know, I'm working on it. I'm definitely connecting to the CYO programs, to the middle school players. I haven't gotten to the elementary level kids yet. But, you know, there's a really nice group of young players. I went through the Amityville days. And then this group is really good. Like, they're sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. It's very, very good. Now, the challenge to me, these kids are being recruited already to private schools. So in Amityville, I never worried about it because I had the connection with the parents, with the families, with the community. Bay Shore, that is the challenge right now. I'm trying to make that connections, but it's just not as easy anymore because last year we dealt with all that COVID stuff. We played 6-7 games. So I built a little relationship, which was really a great story. We ended up making the playoffs, you know, in that short period of time. And I took over in Bay Shore the day of tryouts. I was hired the day of tryouts, or the day before tryouts. So I take over and you know, I pulled this team together and, you know, I guess my experience really helped. And, you know, they weren't the most talented, but they were great kids and hard workers. So we were able to, you know, make it to the playoff round. So now this year, the challenge that I'm facing is that we had two kids that had minor incidents in the school, and the school suspended them for the entire basketball season. Oh my God, that's really hard for me to understand. I think it's important to keep kids in the gym. You know, I'll sit them out of games, but they were very minor situation, but they have really, really strict rules in the school, you know, when it comes to, you know, vape pens and things like that. So I was like, all right, I got to learn to deal with that. Like the district is not the same as Amityville. They have really strict rules. So I have to inform players, you know, how you got to really be on top of your game. You can't get yourself in any trouble. So the two challenges that I'm facing is getting to know the community, but getting to know the school system. You know, I've been out of the school systems, 5-6 years. So it's a little different. No, yes, 5 years. And it's just something that I have to get to that point, like to understand it. The nice part about the whole thing is that the school district hired my brother, who was one of my rivals when we coached against each other. He was my assistant during the LeBron James. And he's my athletic director. So he's my boss right now, which is very hard for me to accept. I'm his older brother, so I've been telling him things what to do his whole career. So he's, you know, he's on like thin ice sometimes. He's afraid to approach me on certain things. And I was like, Chris, just do your job. I'm not going to bite your head off. Not publicly.
Exactly.
On the golf course, I'll let you know how I feel.
There you go.
So it's a nice blessing. And I do believe I am making some good connections with some young family members. Now, again, I'm 59 years old. Like, you know, how long do I really want to continue to do this? And all I kept saying to my wife, the only reason I got back, I want to end my career on a good note in Long Island basketball. And I feel like, you know, in Amityville, it didn't end the way I really wanted mine. I had a very good young group of kids coming up that would have won a state championship. I know it. And I would have got off and rode into the sunset. But I didn't get that opportunity. So I don't know. There's this like burning desire of me when I wake up every morning is to get Bay Shore to the state championship. It's never happened in their district. They've never won a Long Island championship. And there's a lot of talent there, but a lot of talent does leave. They recruit the Catholic schools and the private schools really recruit the area hard. So, you know, there's a new sheriff in town, so hopefully I can keep him around.
Keep him at home, right? Keep the players at home. That's the key. Yeah, you got to keep your guys at home. All right, what's your biggest joy?
Well, you know, every day is a blessing. You know, I thank God every morning I get to wake up. I have a happy family. I got a great wife. It's so nice that you don't have to work all day. Like, I feel bad, like you're teaching all day, and if you were coaching, you know, that's hard.
No, exactly. Yeah, it really is.
My son and my brothers, they all still work all day. And I'm like, God, that seems so hard right now. Even though I did it for 32 years, it just seems so hard. Like, I love to get up, go to the gym, watch some film, and then go to practice, and then you come home. And, you know, college was like a full-time job. This is seriously a part-time job, and I'm trying to put more hours in. Like,
right.
You know, it's just not happening. But it is a blessing every day. And like I said, clearly God has played a major role in my life, and he still does, and he's always there. And, you know, good times and bad times that, you know, my coaching career would have never been where it was without my belief and my faith in God.
Jack, it's well said. And I think that anybody who listens to this hears your passion coming through the microphone for the communities that you've worked in, for the game of basketball, for the kids that you've been fortunate enough to coach. And it's been a lot of fun getting to hear your story and giving you an opportunity to share it. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share, how can people connect with you? How can they find out more about what you're doing at Bay Shore, whether you want to share an email, social media, whatever you feel comfortable putting out there, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Well, I can tell you this. I'm not a big social media guy. I don't really do any of that stuff. But some of my former players really have that Amityville vibe going. So Tristan Smith, talking with Tristan, he has like a YouTube station. He's got a couple of things happening out there. He Fit Lab, he runs his own business, a training business. And he's really good for me, honestly. He puts my stuff out there more than anybody. Like, he's got it on the Facebook.
You got a PR guy. You got a PR guy.
He's a PR guy. And he was a great player. He was a great player. So they're having this big alumni game coming up. And, you know, they want to honor me, which is very nice. And it's April 15th, somewhere around there. And it's going to be a great event. And, you know, if anybody wants to connect with Tristan, you know, he's on Facebook. He's on all social media platforms. And again, he runs the Fit Lab. I wish I had his information in front of me, like where you guys can reach him. But maybe I'll send you an email.
Yeah, we'll figure it out in the meantime. We put the episode together. We'll put it in the show notes and we'll get do some blasts out when the episode goes live.
Yeah, because I think this event that they're trying to run in Amityville, you know, it's going to be really, really special. And Tristan, they have like a draft. Like they have an alumni, so they have four coaches. Mike James is one player coach. Jason Frazier is another player coach. AJ Price and his kid Mark Johnson are the other coach, and Tristan. So they have four different generations of kids, and we put together a list of about, I don't know, four, maybe like 30, 40 guys, and they're all going to play in this big alumni game in April. And I think it's going to be a great event, and you know, definitely the local area is going to jump on it, the local media, because these are all great players. You're talking about two NBA players, Mike James and AJ Price, and you talk about Jason Frazier, who was top, was a McDonald's All-American top five, who coached in the NBA with the Phoenix Suns, and then you got Tristan Smith, who went to St. John's. You know, these are unbelievable athletes and kids from Long Island. So they're giving back to the community, which I really like. And I like that they really, they're always checking in on me, which is really nice. And I like, they know, you know, Amityville didn't treat me right at the end, but I always tell these kids that they can never, never take away my relationships with you. No matter what you can do in this world to me, basketball, you took the game away from me for a little while, you couldn't take the relationships that I built. And to that, I am eternally grateful that I had the opportunity to coach in Amityville.
Jack, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us. A special thanks to your brother for putting us on to your story, and to people who are out there, if you get a chance to go and watch the documentary, Small Town Greatness, make sure you look it up. You can do a search. You can find it if you want to see more of Jack's story and learn even more about what he was able to accomplish at Amityville. So again, Jack, thank you. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.